From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, you'll hear about a plan to launch an operation to take back the city of Mosul from Islamic State. A conference on extremism has concluded in Washington.
If anyone had any doubt that this is our war as Muslims and our collective war as an international community, that doubt has been removed.
We hear from our reporter Pam Dawkins and consternation in India over a tree planted there by President Obama. All ahead on International Edition. A top U.S. military official said Thursday Iraqi and Kurdish fighters plan to launch an operation in April or May to take back the city of Mosul from Islamic State. The official from U.S. Central Command, who spoke under condition of anonymity, said up to 25,000 Iraqi troops will make up the main attack force. Kurdish Peshmerga fighters would contain Islamic State from the north and west of the city. VOA's Michael Lippin spoke with our Defense Department correspondent, Carla Babb, about this development.
What did the Central Command official announce about this impending assault on Mosul?
Well, the U.S. Central Command official said that they are planning to recapture the city of Mosul from Islamic State fighters in the April to May timeframe. They've said that if the Iraqi forces are not ready at that time, that they would be open to pushing this to a later date, but that is what they're shooting for. They're saying that they want to take the city with 20 to 25,000 troops. That would be comprised of about five Iraqi brigades, three smaller brigades for a reserve force, so to speak, three Peshmerga brigades to kind of help contain the region from the north and the west, and then also what they're calling a, quote, Mosul fighting force, which is comprised of police and some tribal units and formal Mosul police as well.
Why do you think the Central Command is talking about this upcoming assault on Mosul at this time? I mean, it seems a little strange to me that you might telegraph, to your enemy that, hey, in 2 months, we're going to come and kick you out of Mosul.
You know, Michael, I was thinking the same thing, and I was talking to another colleague of mine who had heard it with me, and they were wondering the same thing as well. But all I can say is the confidence that this U.S. Central Command official had when he was giving this information. They feel that when this attack occurs, if there are 20 to 25,000 troops, there are currently in Mosul about 2,000 Islamic State fighters is what they estimate. So this will be a 10-to-1 fight. This will be a massive undertaking. And they are basically trying to say to the Islamic State, if you hear our plans, it doesn't matter because we are prepared to completely push you out. They were also talking about how Islamic State fighters are in decline militarily across Iraq. They said that Iraqi and Kurdish forces have retaken about 700 to 800 square kilometers of territory that the Islamic State once controlled in the past. And the CENTCOM official that I spoke with, he assessed that the Islamic State was down to nearly three-fourths of a U.S. Army division worth of combat power. Now, I know a U.S. Army division is about 10,000 to 30,000 troops, so if you look at three-fourths of that, you would think that's between the 8,000 and 20,000 range, and you're talking about also the power, the capabilities that they have, the equipment that they have. So they are losing a lot of fighters that this CENTCOM official says they're not being able to replenish very quickly.
Even with 2,000 Islamic State fighters in Mosul, how much of a challenge is it to dislodge them from a big city like that?
Well, that is the challenge because it's urban terrain. And urban terrain, it's not just that you go in and fight because you have to have very strategic, very precise operations. The U.S. Central Command official also told me that they have not ruled out whether or not U.S. troops will be needed on the ground to help make these air attacks, to make sure that they are precise enough. Because, of course, in any operation, the possibility of having civilian casualties has to be minimized to make it safe enough before the operation could even occur.
Well, moving on to Syria, there were reports today that the United States and Turkey and other partners in the region have made reached an agreement to help arm the moderate rebels that are fighting in Syria against the Assad regime. What can you tell us about that?
I can tell you that the U.S. Central Command official confirmed that today. He said that technical agreement was just signed. The facility that they are offering, he says, is a nearly turnkey facility. It's very close to being ready to go and ready to have Syrian rebels come in and come train. Jordan has also offered a facility, and this official told me that this facility is also ready to go. The U.S. military is working through some final technical agreements with them at this time. Saudi Arabia is another country that has offered a training site, and this central command official has told me that this training site will take about 30 to 90 days to bring this facility online, and the last facility that has been offered is from Qatar. The official told me that they have offered a site, but that will take 6 to 9 months to get ready to become fully online.
Make sure you stay with us on The Voice of America with updates on both of those stories. That was VOA Defense Department correspondent Carla Baz speaking with my colleague Michael Lippin. The United States has announced a series of regional summits and other events to galvanize international efforts to combat violent extremism. Secretary of State John Kerry discussed the issue Thursday as delegates from more than 60 countries gathered in Washington, seeking ways to counter efforts by extremists to recruit and radicalize. VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins has more.
As nations cope with atrocities by the Islamic State, Boko Haram, and similar groups, world leaders are seeking ways to loosen the grip of violent extremists. Nations must work together to stop extremist groups' messages of hate, according to Secretary of State Kerry.
Poisonous ideas can come from almost anywhere, from parents, teachers, friends, preachers, politicians, from the pretty woman on a radical website who lures people, or the man in the next cell who proselytizes while in prison.
One country dealing with extremist violence is Jordan, after Islamic State militants captured one of its pilots in Syria and used social media to show his violent death. The country's foreign affairs minister, Nasser Judeh, says violent extremism has no religious boundaries.
If anyone had any doubt that this is our war as Muslims and our collective war as an international community, that doubt has been removed.
The United States estimates more than 20,000 foreign fighters have joined the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, with at least 3,400 coming from Western nations. To fight the recruiting efforts of extremist groups, the White House is trying to bolster community engagement in building awareness and looking for signs of radicalization. That's especially important for young people who may feel trapped in impoverished communities, says President Obama.
Where there is no order and no path for advancement, where there are no educational opportunities, where there are no ways to support families, and no escape from injustice and the humiliations of corruption. That feeds instability and disorder and makes those communities ripe for extremist recruitment.
The White House says religious leaders are key to combating extremist violence, like last month's deadly attacks in Paris. In a VOA interview, the Mufti of Tirana, Albania, called Islamic State extremists monsters playing on human faith.
I feel pain and am shocked by this barbarity of the 21st century that ISIS is conducting.
President Obama has requested nearly $400 million for the State Department to support counterterrorism partnerships, including new outreach efforts, says National Security Advisor Susan Rice.
The United States will launch new initiatives to build the capacity of partners in North Africa and the Sahel to develop strategies that counter violent extremism. And we're going to track our collective progress with future meetings to make sure our efforts remain linked up.
The U.S. and its global partners plan to assess their progress in the fight against extremism at the U.N. General Assembly in September. Pam Dawkins, VOA News, the State Department.
We We shift our attention now to Ukraine. A military spokesman there says pro-Russian separatists fired on Ukrainian positions repeatedly during the overnight hours, that despite a ceasefire that came into effect 5 days ago. Anatoly Stelmach said Friday the rebels have been concentrating their attacks in the vicinity of Donetsk, shelling the village of Karakova to the west. He also said the village of Berdyansk near the port city of Mariupol was hit by artillery and mortar fire during the night. Mariupol, the main seaport in eastern Ukraine, was the scene of intense fighting last year before Ukrainian forces took control of the city. On Thursday, the leaders of Ukraine, Russia, France, and Germany pledged renewed support for the ceasefire in eastern Ukraine. The four leaders who negotiated the truce condemned the fighting and urged both sides to observe the ceasefire, which has seen a series of violations. The pro-Russian separatists are fresh off of a victory over Ukrainian forces at the railway hub of Debaltseve. The separatists, including many Cossack fighters, celebrated on Thursday the retreat of the Ukrainian forces from Debaltseve, as Ukrainian military officials reported the deaths of at least 134 retreating soldiers. Officials said more than 90 others were captured, with dozens of others unaccounted for. As to describe post-withdrawal conditions in Debaltseve, another Ukrainian military spokesman compared the devastated town to the lifeless surface of the moon. Andrei Lysenko, speaking to Ukraine's Channel 5 television, said Debaltseve had, in his words, ceased to exist as significant to the region after shelling devastated the once-thriving town of 27,000 people. Associated Press reporters in the town reported all neighborhoods under the control of rebel fighters. White House officials in Washington said Wednesday it is crystal clear that Russia, the separatists, and eastern Ukraine are not living up to the ceasefire agreement, but warned this puts them at risk of greater costs. Ukrainians are marking the first anniversary of Kyiv protests that led to the ouster of a pro-Russian president and subsequent fighting in Ukraine's Russian-speaking east. After more than 5,600 deaths and much destruction, the country continues to suffer from a political and economic crisis. Vlada Chahuk reports the number of displaced Ukrainians that depend on humanitarian aid is on the rise.
100 protesters were killed in Kyiv's Maidan Square in February of last year. Those close to the so-called Heavenly Hundred are learning to live without them.
I remember everything. His every gesture, every step, smile, every phrase. It is difficult, but life goes on. We have children. We need to live. We need to fight.
Ihor Kulchitsky survived last year's crackdown on protesters, but his father, Volodymyr, a general in the Ukrainian army, was killed several months later when pro-Russian separatists in eastern Ukraine downed his helicopter.
God gave him the death of a warrior. It means that had to happen. What is important is that this should not be for nothing.
Despite last week's truce, rebels continue to fight for control of key territory in eastern Ukraine. Civilians in those areas report living in fear, hunger, and cold.
Up there, a woman was killed. All they found was pieces of her body below. 14 people were killed.
Russia's annexation of Crimea and fighting in the rest of eastern Ukraine have prompted more than a million people to leave their homes. The United Nations Food Agency announced Thursday it is boosting its aid for Ukraine.
We're scaling up our operations in Ukraine to reach probably about 190,000 people in the coming weeks, because the needs are growing as people are still having to flee their homes and they're living in very difficult places, in shelters, with other families. Our colleagues recently have been to see people who are living in a railway station, in a sleeping wagon.
The World Food Program says food prices in the region have risen dramatically, up to 30% for milk and bread, and 70% to 80% for meat and cheese. Some people, like this mother in the eastern town of Kramatorsk, have depended on food vouchers for months.
Can it be that a country that was as rich as ours was before cannot feed itself and is dependent on others for help?
The World Food Program hands out food vouchers in relatively stable areas where food can be purchased. In areas closer to the front line, it provides traditional food rations.
It's a drop in the ocean. The needs are great. Right now we're prepositioning food, hoping that the ceasefire will hold and we're able to push food to over 60,000 people near the front lines.
Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko has called for international peacekeepers to enforce the shaky ceasefire. Zlatica Ho, VOA News, Washington.
As fighting continues in northern Myanmar along China's southern border, the government in Beijing is grappling with a flood of refugees, as well as many questions about how Chinese authorities should respond to the conflict. VOA's Bill Ide has more now from Beijing.
Myanmar's military has declared martial law and a state of emergency in the northern area of the Kekong Special Region. But that has not put an end to the clashes with armed ethnic rebels. The Myanmar government says that in addition to Kekong fighters, Kachin and other ethnic rebel groups have joined the fight, which has already displaced tens of thousands. Many have fled into China's Zhengkang County in southern Yunnan province, a key crossing point near where the fighting is taking place. Residents there say that in addition to a flood of refugees, there is now a strong presence of armed forces on the Chinese side to maintain security, raising tensions. The last round of fighting between rebels and the Myanmar army in 2009 led to the ousting of rebel leader Peng Jiasheng. Peng spent years in hiding but now has returned and is seeking to reclaim his position as the head of the Kekong Autonomous Region. Some of those who have fled are hoping he does just that. Zhao works in a restaurant in Zhengkang near the border. Zhao says many hope that Peng wins the fight and say that things were much better before he was ousted. They say that after Myanmar authorities took over, they have not been treated well, he adds. Peng's return to Kekong has also put increasing pressure on the Beijing government because of the sympathies that some Chinese feel for his cause and the fact that Kekong are ethnic Chinese. Before the recent conflict began, Peng gave interviews to Chinese media and sent an open letter to Chinese around the world, urging them to support their brothers in Kekong. That letter and recent photos posted online of dead Kekong in the streets have stirred up a nationalistic debate on the internet, with some urging the Chinese government to take action. Some have even drawn comparisons to Crimea. The Myanmar government has urged Beijing to prevent attacks from being launched from across the border. But there are also signs of support from other ethnic groups inside Myanmar. One refugee tells Chinese language broadcaster Phoenix Television. The refugee says that the reason why other groups are supporting the Kekong in this fight is because we do not have ethnic equality. He says the Myanmar government will not give them identification cards, and because of that, they will not be able to participate in the elections. Myanmar will hold elections later this year, but many details are still being sorted out. Ethnic Kekong are not considered Burmese citizens, but they have government-issued ID cards. However, a recent ruling by Myanmar's parliament means those cards will expire at the end of March, and cardholders will be unable to vote. It is unclear if the law will be changed before the election. In an interview with China's Communist Party-backed Global Times late last year, Peng Jiasheng said that political talks are the only way to resolve Myanmar's problems in the north. But he said that the group may have no choice but to fight. Peng also called on China to play a role in facilitating a solution. Yun Sun is an East Asia Fellow at the Stimson Center, a Washington, D.C.-based research group. She says that while Peng's ambitions are relatively clear, he still faces obstacles.
But the problem here is Peng Jiasheng is not recognized by far by the Burmese authorities as a legitimate political force. So for him to gain that political capital, he will have to start with something. And the military offensive in Kekong region is clearly targeted at restoring that control and leading to a political legitimacy for him to play a role.
Myanmar-China relations have gone through a major shift since the country, also known as Burma, began taking steps toward democracy. The combination of the rebalance of U.S. presence to Asia and the cancellation of a major dam project in Myanmar has led some Chinese scholars to advocate more engagement with ethnic groups across the border as leverage. But Yun Sun says that supporting ethnic rebels against the government seems unlikely. because Beijing has much larger ambitions for national trade and energy exports.
So from China's perspective, the Myanmar government has much more to offer for China's national interest than the border ethnic groups. And if China wants to gain Myanmar government's friendship and gain their trust, China should not adopt a position that align itself with the border ethnic groups, and China should not provide support to the border ethnic groups.
Still, she says that given the porous nature of the border and the heavy amount of trade that goes on there, it is not inconceivable for some local actors to have different views from the central government, and that they could be providing those across the border with support. She adds that while this does not represent the central government's position, what the Chinese government will do to address the conflicting demands remains unclear. Bill Eyde, VOA News, Beijing.
And now the story from India, where there is big news being made. Officials there want to make one thing clear. The tree that President Barack Obama planted in New Delhi 3 weeks ago is not dead. It just looks that way. The peepal tree was awash in leaves when the president planted it. It has now lost all of its leaves, but officials there say that's the way the peepal tree works. All normal. Thanks for joining us today for International Edition. Get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events at voanews.com. I'm Ira Melbourne in Washington. Thanks for being with us.
This is Today in History. On February 20th, 1835, the Concepcion earthquake occurred near the neighboring cities of Concepcion and Talcahuano in Chile. Both cities were destroyed, but only about 50 people were killed. On this day in 1872, New York's Metropolitan Museum of Art first opened its doors to the public. The Met is one of the world's largest and most important art museums, with a permanent collection of more than 2 million works of art. In 1895, abolitionist Frederick Douglass died. Douglass, a former slave, was one of the most prominent black leaders in American history. In 1944, the so-called Big Week, an Allied strategic bombing campaign in Europe, began. The operation involved hundreds of bombers that attacked German aircraft assembly plants, airfields, and other important targets. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Jordan is a stable, moderate presence in a turbulent part of the world and remains a critical partner for the United States on a range of issues, including the Syrian crisis, the Middle East peace process, and countering violent extremism. The United States and Jordan share a commitment to promoting regional security and stability, furthering Jordan's economic development, and advancing social, political, and economic reform in Jordan. We recognize Jordan's increased immediate needs resulting from regional unrest, the efforts Jordan is undertaking at the forefront of the fight against ISIL and other extremist ideology and terrorism, the influx of hundreds of thousands of refugees from Syria and Iraq, the disruption of foreign energy supplies, and other unprecedented strains. According to Jordan's foreign minister, Nasser Judeh, Jordan is hosting about 800,000 registered refugees and some 700,000 economic migrants. This means that the refugee population in Jordan stands at approximately 21% of the overall population, and in the words of Foreign Minister Judeh, is something that no country, regardless of political or economic might, can cope with. Consequently, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and Foreign Minister Judeh signed a new memorandum of understanding that reflects our strategic partnership and the United States' firm commitment to Jordan's stability. In the past 5 years, the level of assistance in this memorandum was $600 million annually. Starting now and continuing through 2017, that level will go up sharply to $1 billion a year, which covers a wide range of programs in the areas of economic support, technical help, and security, said Secretary Kerry. The increase from the previous MOU is designed to address Jordan's short-term extraordinary needs, including those related to regional instability and rising energy costs. The provisions of this memorandum will strengthen the forces of civility and moderation everywhere, said Secretary Kerry, because it will bolster a country and a leadership team that has been steadfast in its support for both.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.